I pulled up a map of Ludus on my display. It appeared as a three-dimensional globe floating in front of me, and I gave it a spin with my hand. Ludus was a relatively small planet by Oasis standards, about a third the size of Earth's moon, with a circumference of exactly 1,000 kilometers. A single contiguous continent covered the surface. There were no oceans, just a few dozen large lakes placed here and there. Since Oasis planets weren't real, they didn't have to obey the laws of nature. On Ludus, it was perpetually daytime, regardless of where you stood on the surface, and the sky was always a perfect cloudless blue. The stationary sun that hung overhead was nothing but a virtual light source, programmed into the imaginary sky. On the map, the school campuses appeared as thousands of identical numbered rectangles dotting the planet's surface. They were separated by rolling green fields, rivers, mountain ranges, and forests. The forests were of all shapes and sizes, and many of them bordered one of the schools. Next to the map, I pulled up the Tomb of Horrors module. Near the front, it contained a crude illustration of the hill concealing the tomb. I took a screenshot of this illustration and placed it in the corner of my display. I frantically searched my favorite wares sites until I found a high-end image recognition plugin for the Oasis Atlas. Once I downloaded the software via GunTorrent, it took me a few more minutes to figure out how to make it scan the entire surface of Ludus for a hill with large black stones arranged in a skull-like pattern, one with a size, shape, and appearance that matched the illustration from the Tomb of Horrors module. After about 10 minutes of searching, the software highlighted a possible match. I held my breath as I placed the close-up image from the Ludus map beside the illustration from the D&D module. The shape of the hill and the skull pattern of the stones both matched the illustration perfectly. I decreased the magnification on the map a bit, then pulled back far enough to confirm that the northern edge of the hill ended in a cliff of sand and crumbling gravel, just like in the original Dungeons & Dragons module. I let out a triumphant yell that echoed in the empty classroom and bounced off the walls of my tiny hideout. I'd done it. I'd actually found the Tomb of Horrors. When I finally managed to calm down, I did some quick calculations. The hill was near the center of a large amoeba-shaped forest located on the opposite side of Ludus, over 400 kilometers from my school. My avatar could run at a maximum speed of 5 kilometers an hour, so it would take me over 3 days to get there on foot if I ran nonstop the entire time. If I could teleport, I could be there within minutes. The fare wouldn't be much for such a short distance, maybe a few hundred credits. Unfortunately, that was still more than my current Oasis account balance, which was a big fat zero. I considered my options. H would lend me the money for the fare, but I didn't want to ask for his help. If I couldn't reach the tomb on my own, I didn't deserve to reach it at all. Besides, I'd have to lie to H about what the money was for, and since I'd never asked him for a loan before, any excuse I gave would make him suspicious. Thinking about H, I couldn't help but smile. He was really going to freak when he found out about this. The tomb was hidden less than 70 kilometers from his school, practically his backyard. That thought triggered an idea, one that made me leap to my feet. I ran out of the classroom and down the hall. Not only had I figured out a way to teleport to the other side of Ludus, I knew how to get my school to pay for it. Each Oasis public school had a bunch of different athletic teams, including wrestling, soccer, football, baseball, volleyball, and a few other sports that couldn't be played in the real world, like Quidditch and Zero Gravity Capture the Flag. Students went out for these teams just like they did at schools in the real world, and they played using elaborate sports-capable haptic rigs that required them to actually do all of their own running, jumping, kicking, tackling, and so on. The teams had nightly practice, held pep rallies, and traveled to other schools on Ludus to compete against them. Our school gave out free teleportation vouchers to any student who wanted to attend an away game, so we could sit up in the stands and root for old OPS 1873. I'd only taken advantage of this once when our Capture the Flag team had played against H's school in the OPS championships. When I arrived in the school office, I scanned the activities schedule and found what I was looking for right away. That evening, our football team was playing an away game against OPS 571, which was located roughly an hour's run from the forest where the tomb was hidden. I reached out and selected the game, and a teleportation voucher instantly appeared in my avatar's inventory, good for one free round trip to OPS 571. I stopped at my locker long enough to drop off my textbooks and grab my flashlight, sword, shield, and armor. Then, I sprinted out the front entrance and across the expansive green lawn in front of the school. When I reached the red borderline that marked the edge of the school grounds, I glanced around to make sure no one was watching me, then stepped across the line. As I did, the Wade 3 name tag floating above my head changed to read Parzival. Now that I was off school grounds, I could use my avatar name once again. I could also turn off my name tag completely, which was what I did now because I wanted to travel incognito. The nearest transport terminal was a short walk from the school at the end of a cobblestone path. It was a large, domed pavilion supported by a dozen ivory pillars. Each pillar bore an Oasis teleportation icon, a capital T in the center of a blue hexagon. School had only been out for a few minutes now, so there was a steady stream of avatars filing into the terminal. Inside were long rows of blue teleportation booths. Their shape and color always reminded me of Doctor Who's TARDIS. I stepped into the first empty booth I saw, and the doors closed automatically. I didn't need to enter my destination on the touchscreen because it was already encoded on my voucher. I just slid the voucher into a slot, and a world map of Ludus appeared on the screen, showing a line from my present location to my destination, a flashing green dot next to OPS 571. The booth instantly calculated the distance I would be traveling, 462 kilometers, and the amount my school would be invoiced for the fare, 103 credits. The voucher was verified, the fare showed as paid, and my avatar vanished. I instantly reappeared in an identical booth inside an identical transport terminal on the opposite side of the planet. As I ran outside, I spotted OPS 571 off to the south. It looked exactly like my own school, except the surrounding landscape was different. I spotted some students from my school walking toward the nearby football stadium on their way to watch the game and root for our team. I wasn't sure why they bothered. They could just as easily have watched the game via vid feed, and any empty seats in the stands would be filled with randomly generated NPC fans who would wolf down virtual sodas and hot dogs while cheering wildly. Occasionally, they would even do the wave. I was already running in the opposite direction, across a rolling green field that stretched out behind the school. A small mountain range loomed in the distance, and I could see the amoeba-shaped forest at its base. I turned on my avatar's auto-run feature, then opened my inventory and selected three of the items listed there. My armor appeared on my body, my shield appeared in a sling on my back, and my sword appeared in its scabbard, hanging at my side. I was almost to the edge of the forest when my phone rang. The ID said it was H, probably calling to see why I hadn't logged into the basement yet. But if I answered the call, he would see a live video feed of my avatar running across a field at top speed with OPS 571 shrinking in the distance behind me. I could conceal my current location by taking the call as audio only, but that might make him suspicious. So I let the call roll to my vidmail. H's face appeared in a small window on my display. He was calling from a PvP arena somewhere. Dozens of avatars were locked in fierce combat on a multi-tiered playing field behind him. "Yo, Z, what are you up to? Jerking off to Lady Hawk?" He flashed his Cheshire grin. "Give me a shout. I'm still planning to pop some corn and have a spaced marathon. You down?" He hung up, and his image winked out. I sent a text-only reply, saying I had a ton of homework and couldn't hang tonight. Then I pulled up the Tomb of Horrors module and began to read through it again, page by page. I did this slowly and carefully because I was pretty sure it contained a detailed description of everything I was about to face. In the far reaches of the world, under a lost and lonely hill, read the module's introduction, lies the sinister Tomb of Horrors. This labyrinthine crypt is filled with terrible traps, strange and ferocious monsters, rich and magical treasures, and somewhere within rests the evil Demi-Lich. That last bit worried me. A lich was an undead creature, usually an incredibly powerful wizard or king who had employed dark magic to bind his intellect to his own reanimated corpse, thus achieving a perverted form of immortality. I'd encountered liches in countless video games and fantasy novels. They were to be avoided at all costs. I studied the map of the tomb and the descriptions of its many rooms. The tomb's entrance was buried in the side of a crumbling cliff. A tunnel led down into a labyrinth of 33 rooms and chambers, each filled with a variety of vicious monsters, deadly traps, and, mostly cursed, treasure. If you somehow managed to survive all of the traps and find your way through the labyrinth, you would eventually reach the crypt of Acererak the Demi-Lich. The room was littered with treasure. But if you touched it, the undead King Acererak appeared and opened up a can of undead whoop-ass on you. If, by some miracle, you managed to defeat the Lich, you could take his treasure and leave the dungeon. Mission accomplished, quest completed. If Halliday had recreated the Tomb of Horrors just as it was described in the module, I was in big trouble. My avatar was a third-level wimp with non-magical weapons and 27 measly hit points. Nearly all of the traps and monsters described in the module could kill me easily. And if I somehow managed to make it past all of them and reach the crypt, the ultra-powerful Lich could kill my avatar in seconds just by looking at him. But I had a few things going for me. First, I really didn't have much to lose. If my avatar was killed, I would lose my sword, shield, and leather armor, and the 3 levels I'd managed to gain over the past few years. I'd have to create a new first-level avatar, which would spawn at my last login location, in front of my school locker. But then I could just return to the tomb and try again. And again. And again. Every night, collecting XPs and increasing in levels until I finally figured out where the copper key was hidden. There was no such thing as a backup avatar. Oasis users could have only one avatar at a time. It was possible for hackers to use modded visors to spoof their retinal patterns and thus create a second account for themselves. But if you got caught, you'd be banned from the Oasis for life, and you'd also be disqualified from participating in Halliday's contest. No Gunter would ever take that risk. My other advantage, I hoped, was that I knew exactly what to expect once I entered the tomb, because the module provided me with a detailed map of the entire labyrinth. It also told me where all the traps were located and how to disarm or avoid them. I also knew which rooms contained monsters and where all of the weapons and treasure were hidden. Unless, of course, Halliday had changed things around. Then I was screwed. But at the moment, I was far too excited to be worried. After all, I'd just made the biggest, most important discovery of my life. I was just a few minutes away from the hiding place of the Copper Key. I finally reached the edge of the forest and ran inside. It was filled with thousands of perfectly rendered maples, oaks, spruces, and tamaracks. The trees looked as though they had been generated and placed using standard Oasis landscape templates, but the detail put into them was stunning. I stopped to examine one of the trees closely and saw ants crawling along the intricate ridges in its bark. I took this as a sign I was on the right track. There was no path through the forest, so I kept the map in the corner of my display and followed it to the skull-topped hill that marked the tomb entrance. It was right where the map said it would be, in a large glade at the center of the forest. As I stepped into the clearing, my heart felt like it was trying to beat its way out of my ribcage. I climbed up onto the low hilltop, and it was like stepping into the illustration from the D&D module. Halliday had reproduced everything exactly. 12 massive black stones were arranged on the hilltop in the same pattern, resembling the features of a human skull. I walked to the northern edge of the hilltop and descended the crumbling cliff face I found there. By consulting the module map, I was able to locate the exact spot in the cliff where the entrance to the tomb was supposed to be buried. Then, using my shield as a shovel, I began to dig. Within a few minutes, I uncovered the mouth of a tunnel that led into a dark underground corridor. The floor of the corridor was a mosaic of colorful stones with a winding path of red tiles set into it. Once again, just like in the D&D module. I moved the Tomb of Horrors dungeon map to the top right corner of my display and made it slightly transparent. Then I strapped my shield to my back and took out my flashlight. I glanced around once more to make sure no one was watching me. Then, clutching my sword in my other hand, I entered the Tomb of Horrors. Chapter 8. The walls of the corridor leading into the tomb were covered with dozens of strange paintings depicting enslaved humans, orcs, elves, and other creatures. Each fresco appeared in the exact location described in the original D&D module. I knew that hidden in the tiled stone surface of the floor were several spring-loaded trap doors. If you stepped on one, it snapped open and dropped you into a pit filled with poisoned iron spikes. But because the location of each hidden trap door was clearly marked on my map, I was able to avoid all of them. So far, everything had followed the original module to the letter. If the same was true for the rest of the tomb, I might be able to survive long enough to locate the copper key. There were only a few monsters lurking in this dungeon. A gargoyle, a skeleton, a zombie, some asps, a mummy, and the evil demi-lich Acererak himself. Since the map told me where each of them was hiding, I should be able to avoid fighting them. Unless, of course, one of them was guarding the copper key. And I could already guess who probably had that honor. I tried to proceed carefully, as if I had no idea what to expect. Avoiding the sphere of annihilation located at the end of the corridor, I located a hidden door beside the last pit trap. It opened into a small, sloping passageway. My flashlight reached into the darkness ahead, flickering off the damp stone walls. My surroundings made me feel like I was in a low-budget sword and sorcery flick, like Hawk the Slayer or the Beastmaster. I began to make my way through the dungeon, room by room. Even though I knew where all of the traps were located, I still had to proceed carefully to avoid them all. In a dark, forbidding chamber known as the Chapel of Evil, I found thousands of gold and silver coins hidden in the pews, right where they were supposed to be. It was more money than my avatar could carry, even with the bag of holding that I found. I gathered up as many of the gold coins as I could, and they appeared in my inventory. The currency was automatically converted, and my credit counter jumped to over $20,000, by far the largest amount of money I'd ever had. And in addition to the credits, my avatar received an equal number of experience points for obtaining the coins. As I continued deeper into the tomb, I obtained several magic items along the way. A +1 flaming sword, a gem of seeing, a +1 ring of protection. I even found a suit of +3 full plate armor. These were the first magic items my avatar had ever possessed, and they made me feel unstoppable. When I put on the suit of magical armor, it shrank to fit my avatar perfectly. Its gleaming chrome appearance reminded me of the badass armor worn by the knights in Excalibur. I actually switched to a third-person view for a few seconds just to admire how cool my avatar looked wearing it. The farther I went, the more confident I became. The tomb's layout and contents continued to match the module description exactly, down to the last detail. That is, until I reached the pillared throne room. It was a large, square chamber with a high ceiling filled with dozens of massive stone columns. A huge, raised dais stood at the far end of the room, atop which rested an obsidian throne inlaid with silver and ivory skulls. All this matched the module description exactly, with one huge difference. The throne was supposed to be empty, but it wasn't. The Demi-Lich Acererac was sitting on it, glaring down at me silently. A dusty gold crown glinted on his withered head. He appeared exactly as he did on the cover of the original Tomb of Horrors module. But according to its text, Acererac wasn't supposed to be here. He was supposed to be waiting in a burial chamber much deeper in the dungeon. I considered running, but decided against it. If Halliday had placed the Lich in this room, perhaps he'd placed the copper key here too. I had to find out. I walked across the chamber to the foot of the dais. From here, I could see the Lich more clearly. His teeth were two rows of pointed cut diamonds arrayed in a lipless grin, and a large ruby was set in each of his eye sockets. For the first time since entering the tomb, I wasn't sure what to do next. My chances of surviving one-on-one combat with a demi-lich were non-existent. My wimpy +1 flaming sword couldn't even affect him, and the two magic rubies in his eye sockets had the power to suck out my avatar's life force and kill me instantly. Even a party of 6 or 7 high-level avatars would have had a difficult time defeating him. I silently wished, not for the last time, that the Oasis was like an old adventure game, and that I could save my place. But it wasn't. And I couldn't. If my avatar died here, it would mean starting over with nothing. But there was no point in hesitating now. If the Lich killed me, I would come back tomorrow night and try again. The entire tomb should reset when the Oasis server clock struck midnight. If it did, all of the hidden traps I'd disarmed would reset themselves, and the treasure and magic items would reappear. I tapped the record icon at the edge of my display so that whatever happened next would be stored in a vidcap file I could play back and study later. But when I tapped the icon, I got a "recording not allowed" message. It seemed that Halliday had disabled recording inside the tomb. I took a deep breath, raised my sword, and placed my right foot on the bottom step of the dais. As I did, there was a sound like cracking bones as Acererac slowly lifted his head. The rubies in his eye sockets began to glow with an intense red light. I took several steps backward, expecting him to leap down and attack me. But he didn't rise from his throne. Instead, He lowered his head and fixed me with his chilling gaze. "Greetings, Parzival," he said in a rasping voice. "What is it that you seek?" This caught me off guard. According to the module, the Lich wouldn't speak. He was just supposed to attack, leaving me with no choice but to kill him or run for my life. "I seek the copper key," I replied. Then I remembered I was speaking to a king, so I quickly bowed my head, dropped to one knee, and added, "Your Majesty."
"Of course you do,"
Acererak said, motioning for me to rise.
"And you've come to the right place."
He stood, and his mummified skin cracked like old leather as he moved. I clutched my sword more tightly, still anticipating an attack.
"How can I know that you are worthy of possessing the copper key?"
he asked. Holy shit. How the hell was I supposed to answer that? And what if I gave the wrong answer? Would he suck out my soul and incinerate me? I racked my brain for a suitable reply. The best I could come up with was, "Allow me to prove my worth, noble Acererak." The Lich let out a long, disturbing cackle that echoed off the chamber's stone walls.
"Very well," he said. "You shall prove your worth by facing me in a joust."
I'd never heard of an undead Lich King challenging someone to a joust, especially not in a subterranean burial chamber. "All right," I said uncertainly. "But won't we be needing horses for that?"
"Not horses," he replied, stepping away from his throne. "Birds."
He waved a skeletal hand at his throne. There was a brief flash of light, accompanied by a transformation sound effect, which I was pretty sure had been lifted from the old Super Friends cartoon. The throne melted and morphed into an old coin-operated video game cabinet. Two joysticks protruded from its control panel, one yellow and one blue. I couldn't help but grin as I read the name on the game's backlit marquee, Joust, Williams Electronics, 1982.
"Best two out of three games," Acererak rasped. "If you win, I shall grant you what you seek."
"What if you win?" I asked, already knowing the answer.
"If I am victorious," the Lich said, the rubies in his eye sockets blazing even brighter, "then you shall die."
A ball of swirling orange flame appeared in his right hand. He raised it threateningly. "Of course," I said. "That was my first guess. I just wanted to double check." The fireball in Acererak's hand vanished. He stretched out his leathery palm, which now held two shiny quarters.
"The games are on me," he said.
He stepped up to the joust machine and dropped both quarters into the left coin slot. The game emitted two low electronic chimes, and the credit counter jumped from 0 to 2. Acererak took hold of the yellow joystick on the left side of the control panel and closed his bony fingers around it.
"Art thou ready?" he croaked.
"Yeah," I said, taking a deep breath. I cracked my knuckles and grabbed the Player 2 joystick with my left hand, poising my right hand over the flap button. Acererak rocked his head from left to right, cracking his neck. It sounded like a snapping tree branch. Then he slapped the two-player button, and the joust began. Joust was a classic 80s arcade game with a strange premise.
Each player controls a knight armed with a lance. Player 1 is mounted on an ostrich, while player 2 is mounted on a stork. You flap your wings to fly around the screen and joust with the other player, and also against several computer-controlled enemy knights, who are all mounted on buzzards. When you crash into an opponent, whoever's lance is higher on the screen wins the joust. The loser is killed and loses a life. Whenever you kill one of the enemy knights, his buzzard craps out a green egg that quickly hatches into another enemy knight if you don't scoop it up in time. There's also a winged pterodactyl that appears once in a while to wreak havoc. I hadn't played Joust in over a year. It was one of H's favorite games, and for a while he'd had a Joust cabinet in his chat room. He used to challenge me to a game whenever he wanted to settle an argument or some asinine pop culture dispute. For a few months, we played almost every day. In the beginning, H was slightly better than I was, and he had a habit of gloating over his victories. This had really irked me, so I started practicing Joust on my own, playing a few games a night against an AI opponent. I honed my skills until I finally got good enough to beat H repeatedly and consistently. Then I began to gloat over him, savoring my revenge. The last time we'd played, I'd rubbed his nose in defeat so mercilessly that he'd flipped out and vowed never to play me again. Since then, we'd used Street Fighter II to settle our disputes. My joust skills were a lot rustier than I thought. I spent the first 5 minutes just trying to relax and to reacquaint myself with the controls and the rhythm of the game. During this time, a Sararak managed to kill me twice, mercilessly slamming his winged mount into mine at the perfect trajectory. He handled the game's controls with the calculated perfection of a machine, which, of course, was exactly what he was. Cutting-edge NPC artificial intelligence, programmed by Halliday himself. By the end of our first game, the moves and tricks I'd picked up during all those marathon bouts with H were starting to come back to me. But a Sararak didn't need a warm-up. He was in perfect form from the outset, and there was no way I could make up for my weak showing at the start of the game. He killed off my last man before I even cleared 30,000 points. Embarrassing.
"One game down, Parzival," he said, flashing a rictus grin. "One more to go."
He didn't waste time by making me stand there and watch him play out the rest of his game. He reached up and found the power switch at the rear of the game cabinet, then flipped it off and back on. After the screen cycled through its chromatic Williams Electronics boot-up sequence, he snatched 2 more quarters out of thin air and dropped them into the game.
"Art thou ready?"
he inquired again, hunching over the control panel. I hesitated a moment, then asked, "Actually, would you mind if we switched sides? I'm used to playing on the left." It was true. When H and I played in the basement, I always took the ostrich side. Being on the right side during the first game had screwed up my rhythm a bit. A Sararak appeared to consider my request for a moment. Then he nodded.
"Certainly," he said.
He stepped back from the cabinet, and we switched sides. It suddenly occurred to me just how absurd this scene was. A guy wearing a suit of armor, standing next to an undead king, both hunched over the controls of a classic arcade game. It was the sort of surreal image you'd expect to see on the cover of an old issue of Heavy Metal or Dragon magazine. A Sararak slapped the 2-player button, and my eyes locked on the screen. The next game started out badly for me, too. My opponent's movements were relentless and precise, and I spent the first few waves just trying to evade him. I was also distracted by the incessant click of his skeletal index finger as he tapped his flap button. I unclenched my jaw and cleared my mind, forcing myself not to think about where I was, who I was playing against, or what was at stake. I tried to imagine that I was back in the basement playing against H. It worked. I slipped into the zone, and the tide began to turn in my favor. I began to find the flaws in the Lich's playing style, the holes in his programming. This was something I'd learned over the years, mastering hundreds of different video games. There was always a trick to beating a computer-controlled opponent. At a game like this, a gifted human player could always triumph over the game's AI, because software couldn't improvise. It could either react randomly or in a limited number of predetermined ways based on a finite number of pre-programmed conditions. This was an axiom in video games and would be until humans invented true artificial intelligence. Our second game came right down to the wire, but by the end of it, I'd spotted a pattern to the Lich's playing technique. By changing my ostrich's direction at a certain moment, I could get him to slam his stork into one of the oncoming buzzards. By repeating this move, I was able to pick off his extra lives, one by one. I died several times myself in the process, but I finally took him down during the 10th wave with no extra lives of my own to spare. I stepped back from the machine and sighed with relief. I could feel rivulets of sweat running down my forehead and around the edge of my visor. I wiped at my face with the sleeve of my shirt, and my avatar mimicked this motion. "Good game," Acerorak said. Then, to my surprise, he offered me his withered claw of a hand. I shook it, chuckling nervously as I did so. "Yeah," I replied. "Good game, man." It occurred to me that, in a weird way, I was actually playing against Halliday. I quickly pushed the thought out of my head, afraid I might psych myself out. Acerorak once again produced two quarters and dropped them into the joust machine. "This one is for all the marvels," he said. "Art thou ready?" I nodded. This time, I took the liberty of slapping the two-player button myself. Our final tie-breaking game lasted longer than the first two combined. During the final wave, so many buzzards filled the screen that it was hard to move without getting dusted by one of them. The Lich and I faced off one final time at the very top of the playing field, both of us incessantly hitting our flap buttons while slamming our joysticks left and right. Acerorak made a final, desperate move to avoid my charge and dropped a micrometer too low. His final mount died in a tiny, pixelated explosion. "Player 2, game over," appeared on the screen, and the Lich let out a long, blood-curdling howl of rage. He smashed an angry fist into the side of the joust cabinet, shattering it into a million tiny pixels that scattered and bounced across the floor. Then he turned to face me. "Congratulations, Parzival," he said, bowing low. "You played well." "Thank you, noble Acerorak," I replied, resisting the urge to jump up and down and shake my ass victoriously in his general direction. Instead, I solemnly returned his bow. As I did, the Lich transformed into a tall human wizard dressed in flowing black robes. I recognized him immediately. It was Halliday's avatar, Anorak. I stared at him, utterly speechless. For years, Gunters had speculated that Anorak still roamed the Oasis, now as an autonomous NPC, Halliday's ghost in the machine. "Now," the wizard said, speaking with Halliday's familiar voice, "your reward." The chamber filled with the sound of a full orchestra. Triumphant horns were quickly joined by a stirring string section. I recognized the music.
It was the last track from John Williams' original Star Wars score, used in the scene where Princess Leia gives Luke and Han their medals, and Chewbacca, as you may recall, gets the shaft. As the music built to a crescendo, Anorak stretched out his right hand. There, resting in his open palm, was the copper key, the item for which millions of people had been searching for the past 5 years. As he handed it to me, the music faded out, and in the same instant, I heard a chime sound. I'd just gained 50,000 experience points, enough to raise my avatar all the way up to 10th level. "Farewell, Sir Parzival," Anorak said. "I bid you good luck on your quest." And before I could ask what I was supposed to do next, or where I could find the first gate, his avatar vanished in a flash of light, accompanied by a teleportation sound effect I knew was lifted from the old 80s Dungeons & Dragons cartoon. I found myself standing alone on the empty dais. I looked down at the copper key in my hand and felt overcome with wonder and elation. It looked just as it had in Anorak's invitation, a simple, antique copper key, its oval-shaped bow embossed with the Roman numeral 1. I turned it over in my avatar's hand, watching the torchlight play across the Roman numeral, and that was when I spotted two small lines of text engraved into the metal. I tilted the key up to the light and read them aloud. "What you seek lies hidden in the trash on the deepest level of Daggerath." I didn't even need to read it a second time. I instantly understood its meaning. I knew exactly where I needed to go and what I would have to do once I got there. Hidden in the trash was a reference to the ancient TRS-80 line of computers made by Tandy and Radio Shack in the 70s and 80s. Computer users of that era had given the TRS-80 the derogatory nickname of Trash 80. What you seek lies hidden in the trash. Halliday's first computer had been a TRS-80 with a whopping 16K of RAM. And I knew exactly where to find a replica of that computer in the Oasis. Every Gunter did. In the early days of the Oasis, Halliday had created a small planet named Middletown, named after his hometown in Ohio. The planet was the site of a meticulous recreation of his hometown as it was in the late 1980s. That saying about how you can never go home again? Halliday had found a way. Middletown was one of his pet projects, and he'd spent years coding and refining it. And it was well known, to Gunters at least, that one of the most detailed and accurate parts of the Middletown simulation was the recreation of Halliday's boyhood home. I'd never been able to visit it, but I'd seen hundreds of screenshots and vidcaps of the place. Inside Halliday's bedroom was a replica of his first computer, a TRS-80 Color Computer 2. I was positive that was where he'd hidden the first gate. And the second line of text inscribed on the copper key told me how to reach it. On the deepest level of Daggerath. Daggerath was a word in Sindarin, the elvish language J.R.R. Tolkien had created for the Lord of the Rings. The word Daggerath meant battle, but Tolkien had spelled the word with just one G, not two. Daggerath, with two G's, could refer only to one thing. An incredibly obscure computer game called Dungeons of Daggerath, released in 1982. The game had been made for just one platform, the TRS-80 Color Computer. Halliday had written in Anorak's Almanac that Dungeons of Daggerath was the game that made him decide he wanted to become a video game designer. And Dungeons of Daggerath was one of the games sitting in the shoebox next to the TRS-80 in the recreation of Halliday's childhood bedroom. So all I had to do was teleport to Middletown, go to Halliday's house, sit down at his TRS-80, play the game, reach the bottom level of the dungeon, and that was where I'd find the first gate. At least, that was my interpretation. Middletown was in Sector 7, a long way from Ludus. But I'd collected more than enough gold and treasure to pay for the teleportation fare to get there. By my avatar's previous standards, I was now filthy rich. I checked the time, 11:03 OST, Oasis server time, which also happened to be Eastern Standard Time. I had 8 hours before I had to be at school. That might be enough time. I could go for it, right now. Sprint like hell, back up through the dungeon to the surface, then hightail it back to the nearest transport terminal. From there, I could teleport directly to Middletown. If I left right now, I should be able to reach Halliday's TRS-80 in under an hour. I knew I should get some sleep first. I'd been logged into the Oasis for almost 15 solid hours. And tomorrow was Friday. I could teleport to Middletown right after school, and then I'd have the whole weekend to tackle the first gate. But who was I kidding? There was no way I'd be able to sleep tonight, or sit through school tomorrow. I had to go now. I began to sprint for the exit, but then stopped in the middle of the chamber. Through the open door, I saw a long shadow bouncing on the wall, accompanied by the echo of approaching footsteps. A few seconds later, the silhouette of an avatar appeared in the doorway. I was about to reach for my sword when I realized I was still holding the copper key in my hand. I shoved it into a pouch on my belt and fumbled my sword out of its scabbard. As I raised my blade, the avatar spoke. Chapter 9. "Who the hell are you?" the silhouette demanded. The voice sounded like it belonged to a young woman, one who was itching for a fight. When I failed to answer, a stocky female avatar stepped out of the shadows and into the chamber's flickering torchlight. She had raven hair, styled Joan of Arc short, and appeared to be in her late teens or early 20s. As she got closer, I realized that I knew her. We'd never actually met, but I recognized her face from the dozens of screenshots she'd posted to her blog over the years. It was Artemis. She wore a suit of scaled gunmetal blue armor that looked more sci-fi than fantasy. Twin blaster pistols were slung low on her hips in quick-draw holsters, and there was a long, curved, elvish sword in a scabbard across her back. She wore fingerless Road Warrior-style racing gloves and a pair of classic Ray-Ban shades. Overall, she seemed to be going for a sort of mid-80s post-apocalyptic cyberpunk girl-next-door look, and it was working for me, in a big way. In a word, hot. As she walked toward me, the heels of her studded combat boots clicked on the stone floor. She halted just out of my sword's reach, but did not draw her own blade. Instead, she slid her shades up onto her avatar's forehead, a blatant affectation, since sunglasses didn't actually affect a player's vision, and looked me up and down, making a show of sizing me up. For a moment, I was too starstruck to speak. To break my paralysis, I reminded myself that the person operating the avatar in front of me might not be a woman at all. This girl, whom I'd been cyber-crushing on for the past 3 years, might very well be an obese, hairy-knuckled guy named Chuck. Once I'd conjured up that sobering image, I was able to focus on my situation and the question at hand. What was she doing here? After 5 years of searching, I thought it was highly improbable that we'd both discovered the Copper Key's hiding place on the same night. Too big of a coincidence.
"Cat got your tongue?" she asked.
I said, "Who the hell are you?"
Like her, I had my avatar's name tag switched off. Clearly, I wanted to remain anonymous, especially under the circumstances.
Couldn't she take the hint?
"Greetings," I said, bowing slightly. "I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez."
She smirked. "Chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain?"
"At your service," I replied, grinning. She'd caught my obscure Highlander quote and thrown another right back at me. It was Artemis, all right.
"Cute."
She glanced over my shoulder, up at the empty dais, then back at me.
"So, spill it. How did you do?"
"Do it what?"
"Jousting against a Sararak,"
she said, as if it were obvious.
Suddenly, I understood. This wasn't the first time she'd been here. I wasn't the first Gunter to decipher the limerick and find the Tomb of Horrors. Artemis had beaten me to it. And since she knew about the joust game, she'd obviously already faced the Lich herself. But if she already had the Copper Key, there wouldn't be any reason for her to come back here. So she clearly didn't have the key yet. She'd faced the Lich at joust, and he'd beaten her. So she'd come back to try again. For all I knew, this could be her 8th or 9th attempt, and she obviously assumed the Lich had beaten me, too.
"Hello," she said, tapping her right foot impatiently. "I'm waiting."
I considered making a break for it, just running right past her, back out through the labyrinth and up to the surface. But if I ran, she might suspect that I had the key and decide to try to kill me to get it. The surface of Ludus was clearly marked as a safe zone on the Oasis map, so no player versus player combat was allowed. But I had no way of knowing if the same was true of this tomb, because it was underground and it didn't even appear on the planet map. Artemis looked like a formidable opponent. Body armor, blaster pistols, and that elvish sword she was carrying might be Vorpal. If even a half of the exploits she'd mentioned on her blog were true, her avatar was probably at least 50th level, or higher. If PvP combat was permitted down here, she'd kick my 10th level ass. So I had to play this cool. I decided to lie.
"I got creamed," I said. "Joust isn't really my game."
She relaxed her posture slightly. That seemed to be the answer she wanted to hear.
"Yeah, same here," she said in a commiserating tone.
"Halliday programmed old King of Sararak with some pretty wicked AI, didn't he? He's insanely hard to beat."
She glanced down at my sword, which I was still brandishing defensively.
"You can put that away. I'm not going to bite you."
I kept my sword raised.
"Is this tomb in a PvP zone?"
"Dunno.
You're the first avatar I've ever run into down here."
She tilted her head slightly and smiled.
"I suppose there's only one way to find out."
She drew her sword lightning fast and turned into a clockwise spin, bringing its glowing blade around and down at me, all in a single blur of motion. At the last second, I managed to tilt my own blade upward to awkwardly parry the attack. But both of our swords halted in mid-air, inches apart, as if held back by some invisible force. A message flashed on my display. "Player versus player combat not permitted here." I breathed a sigh of relief. I wouldn't learn until later that the keys were non-transferable. You couldn't drop one of them or give them to another avatar. And if you were killed while holding one, it vanished right along with your body.
"Well, there you have it," she said, grinning. "This is a no PvP zone after all." She whipped her sword around in a figure-eight pattern, then smoothly replaced it in the scabbard on her back. Very slick. I sheathed my own sword, too, but without any fancy moves. Halliday must not have wanted anyone to duel for the right to joust the king, I said. Yeah, she said, grinning. Lucky for you. Lucky for me, I replied, folding my arms. How do you figure? She motioned to the empty dais behind me. You must really be hurting for hit points right now, after fighting a Sararak. So, if a Sararak beat you at joust, then you had to fight him. Good thing I won, I thought, or else I'd probably be creating a new avatar right about now. I've got hit points galore, I fibbed. That lich was a total wuss. Oh, really? She said suspiciously. I'm 52nd level, and he's nearly killed me every time I've had to fight him. I have to stock up on extra healing potions every time I come down here. She eyed me a moment, then said, I also recognize your sword and the armor you're wearing. You got them both right here in this dungeon, which means they're better than whatever your avatar had before. You look like a low-level wimpazoid to me, Juan Ramirez, and I think you're hiding something. Now that I knew she couldn't attack me, I considered telling her the truth. Why not just whip out the copper key and show it to her? But I thought better of it. The smart move now was to split and head straight for Middletown while I still had a head start. She still didn't have the key and might not get it for several more days. If I hadn't already had so many hours of joust practice under my belt, God knows how many attempts it would have taken me to beat a Sararak. Think what you want, She-Ra, I said, moving past her. Maybe I'll run into you off-world sometime. We can duke it out then. I gave her a small wave. See you around. Where do you think you're going? She said, following me. Home, I said, still walking. But what about the lich and the copper key? She motioned to the empty dais. He'll respawn in a few minutes. When the Oasis server clock hits midnight, the whole tomb resets. If you wait right here, you'll get another shot at beating him without having to make your way through all those traps again first. That's why I've been coming here just before midnight every other day, so I can get in two attempts in a row, back to back. Clever. If I hadn't succeeded on my first try, I wonder how long it would have taken me to figure that out. I thought we could take turns playing against him, I said. I just played him, so it'll be your turn at midnight, okay? Then I'll come back after midnight tomorrow. We can alternate days until one of us beats him. Sound fair? I suppose, she said, studying me. But you should stick around anyway. Something different might happen if there are two avatars here at midnight. Anorak probably prepared for that contingency. Maybe two instances of the Lich will appear, one for each of us to play. Or maybe... I prefer to play in private, I said. Let's just take turns, okay? I was almost to the exit when she stepped in front of me, blocking my path. Come on, hold up a second, she said, her voice softening. Please? I could have kept walking right through her avatar, but I didn't. I was desperate to get to Middletown and locate the first gate, but I was also standing in front of the famous Artemis, someone I'd fantasized about meeting for years. And she was even cooler in person than I'd imagined. I was dying to spend more time with her. I wanted, as the 80s poet Howard Jones would say, to get to know her well. If I left now, I might never run into her again. Listen, she said, glancing at her boots. I apologize for calling you a low-level wimpazoid. That was not cool. I insulted you. It's okay. You were right, actually. I'm only 10th level. Regardless, you're a fellow Gunter,
And a clever one, too, or you wouldn't be standing here. So, I want you to know that I respect you and acknowledge your skills. And I apologize for the trash talk.